are made of much more compact material. Saturn and perhaps Uranus are so low in density, because they are mostly hydrogen and helium, that if you could find a bathtub big enough, Saturn or Uranus would float in it, like a cork. And I don't know of any more dramatic illustration of the difference between a Jovian and terrestrial planet. Imagine taking the Earth and putting it into a giant bathtub and expecting it to float like a cork. And of course, it would sink like the stone that it's made of. The other difference, naturally, is that when you let the water out, Saturn would leave a ring. Well, the difference, basically, between... Thank you, I just want to see if you're still awake. The difference between a Jovian and a terrestrial planet is that the Jovian planets are the ones whose gravities were great enough that when the solar system was forming, they were able to suck in everything from the portion of the solar nebula that happened to surround them, irrespective of what it was. They sucked in the gases, they sucked in the solids. If there were liquids, which would have been very minor, they sucked those in too. And so, at least in the case of Jupiter and Saturn, and perhaps in a modified sense in the case of Uranus and Neptune, they are made of what the universe as a whole is made of. That is, 99% of their atoms are hydrogen and helium, and the remainder are distributed in about the same abundances that we see in the Sun, in nebulae, in the interstellar matter, and so forth and so on. The terrestrial planets, on the other hand, are made of only those substances which were able to be followed at the particular place in the solar nebula where they formed. And so even as the Earth, for example, was forming, over 99% of the matter that was trying to form into it was being lost into space because it was gaseous and our planet's gravity could simply not hold it. And so the Earth is made of only that residuum of matter that was solid and therefore was able to be held together. The gravity of the Earth is less for the simple reason that the Earth is very much tinier, a mere 6 sextillion tons of matter, and that was not able to hold hydrogen, helium, or, in fact, anything else that would have been gaseous at that time. Apparently, at the time the planets were forming, as a portion of the formation of the solar system itself, which of course is mainly the story of the formation of the Sun, it was a minor side event that was going on in the cloud of gas and dust around the Sun. As the planets were forming in that cloud of gas and dust, the Sun was going through its T-Tauri stage. T-Tauri is the name of a star that is doing this right now, that is actually in the final stages of the process of its formation. And it has given its name to a class of about, 200 or 300 stars that are known, that are all doing the same thing, and we believe that these are stars that are in the final stages of formation. A T-Tauri star is very much brighter and hotter than it will be a few tens of millions of years later when it stops being a T-Tauri star and settles down and becomes a normal, well-behaved main-sequence star, which is the kind of star the Sun is today. The T-Tauri stage is a brief period compared to the star's subsequent lifetime as a main-sequence star. Our Sun is going to last as a main-sequence star about 10 billion years, about halfway through that now, and it was a T-Tauri star maybe 100 million years. So it's brief, not by human standards, but by astronomical standards, it's only about 1% of the total lifetime of the star. We think the Sun was a T-Tauri star because of the composition of some of the terrestrial planets, especially the ones closer to the Sun. Mercury, for example, was photographed close-up first by Mariner 10 in 1973, and that was the first example in history that we had of just a single world, in this case, suddenly becoming known in the space of a few hours. Mercury, too, is a little more than a dot of light, as seen through our best telescope, and after the Mariner 10 flyby, we had pictures of about a third of its surface that were actually better photographed than any other planet in the solar system up to that time. Your tape just ran out. Oh, okay. sorry about that, but it was clearly indicating the program. Say again? Can we what? Take a break? Well, look, we're very low on time as it is. I mean, we started 20 minutes late. Well, there's no way to air the place out anyway. There is no air conditioning system. You've got to believe this. So I think, the best thing for me to do is just generate as much hot air as I can in as short a time as I can and get it over with as quickly as possible. Okay, you start up. Except I forgot what I was saying. What was I saying? Mercury. Everybody's first reaction to the pictures of Mercury is it looks just like the moon, by which they mean, duh, it's covered with craters. well, any airless world is going to look like that. But it's really ironic because that's the reaction, because Mercury is totally unlike the Moon on the inside. Mercury is almost entirely metal, iron and nickel and probably some other things. Almost the entire planet, 80% of it, is a giant iron-nickel core with only the outer few hundred miles as that thin veneer of rock that is on the outside. So that's what we see in the Mariner 10 pictures. But the Moon, by contrast, either has no iron core at all, or it's so little we've never been able to prove that it's actually there. Mercury, in other words, is basically a 3,000-mile ball bearing. And apparently the reason for that is that when the planets were forming, 4.5 billion years ago, as the Sun was going through the latter part of its T-Pari stage, the Sun was so hot that at the position of Mercury, 36 million miles away, rock was gaseous. And the only things that were able to be solid and thereby form into a terrestrial planet at that distance were the ones with the very highest boiling point, and those, if you look at the cosmically abundant materials, have to be iron, nickel, and a very few other metals. Only toward the end of the several million year period that it took Mercury to form did the Sun become cool enough that rock was able to solidify and rain down onto the outside to form this thin, rocky exterior. Venus, twice as far away from the Sun, 72 million miles, is made mostly of rock, so apparently rock was able to remain solid there throughout. But Venus is very, very deficient in water as compared to, for example, the Earth. We don't know why this is. One possibility, of course, is that once it had as much water as the Earth and it's since lost it, but a very likely possibility, very, very difficult to dream up reasonable mechanisms for it to lose that much water. And a much more likely possibility, in the opinion of many of the people who have looked at that question, is that Venus simply formed with much less water than, for example, the Earth did. You know what the Earth is made of, 93 million miles from the Sun, but I'd like to point out that Earth, too, is very deficient in water as compared to what you would expect from the cosmic composition. The atoms that make up water, which of course are hydrogen and oxygen, have an abundance compared to the atoms that make up the bulk of the rocks of the Earth, and those are basically silicon plus, again, oxygen, that if we had all of the hydrogen plus oxygen, all of the water that we are really entitled to for a glob of matter of composition, of cosmic composition of our size, the water that makes up the Earth ought to outweigh the rock by a factor of about 3. Obviously, it does not. The bulk of the solid interior of the Earth is rock. Of course, there's a lot of the surface of the Earth is covered by water, but that's negligible compared to the volume of the planet. Mars is still mostly rock, but there is evidence, although this is controversial, that Mars has more water per cubic mile than the Earth does, although still nothing like cosmic abundances. Then, to get to the next terrestrial planet, you have to go 3 times farther out from the Sun than Mars. And what I'm talking about, of course, is not Jupiter itself. That's a Jovian planet that's made mostly of hydrogen and helium because it was able to suck in everything. No, what I'm talking about is the Galilean satellites which revolve around Jupiter. It amazes me how many astronomers, even textbooks, make the statement, you have Jovian planets in the outer solar system and terrestrial planets in the inner solar system. There are plenty of terrestrial planets in the outer solar system. They just happen to be revolving around the even larger Jovian planets that are found there and not here as satellites. And the Galilean satellites, I want to tell you about only the outermost, Callisto, for the moment. Skip over the others and come back to those in just a minute. The outermost of the Galilean satellites is in fact made mostly of water, which outweighs its rock by a factor of 3. And so there you have something that is much more naturally what it should be made of than is the Earth. How do we know this? When Pioneers 10 and 11 flew past Jupiter, we'll get other data from Voyager, but that hasn't been analyzed yet. But when Pioneers 10 and 11 flew past Jupiter, their trajectories were very, very slightly affected by the gravity of the Moon. And from analyzing these effects, we can get how heavy the moons are. We also know how big they are, so we can get their densities. And we know that there are very few substances that are cosmically abundant enough that you have to worry about them when you're considering the sort of geochemical makeup of a planet or a moon. And so you say, well, it has a density of so-and-so, and the only thing that could reasonably be is water. You just rule out other possibilities, for example, cranberry jelly. It may have about the same density, but it's not cosmically abundant enough, you know. So Callisto is in fact made mostly of frozen water. Or maybe some of it has heated up and become liquid at this stage, but it was solid. Water out there, 5 times as far from the Sun as the Earth is, was cool enough that even when the Sun was going through its T-Pari stage, water was able to solidify. And there were little ice crystals, and those incorporated themselves into the makeup of that particular terrestrial planet, Callisto. When you get to Titan, which is the next terrestrial planet, that is twice as far out again. Saturn, you gotta remember how rapidly the blocks get bigger in the outer solar system. People often forget that, for example, Saturn is as far from Jupiter, farther from Jupiter than Earth is. You know, every planet out there is about twice as far, roughly twice as far out as the next one in. And so the next terrestrial planet out is Titan, the big moon of Saturn, and we think that Titan is made of a mixture of frozen water, frozen ammonia, which also is a substance whose atoms are abundant enough that they should outweigh rock if you're getting anywhere close to cosmic abundances, and just a little bit of silicates, just a little bit of rock left over. Then Uranus does not have any large satellites. It has no real terrestrial planets in orbit around it. Neptune has Triton, about which we know virtually nothing, not even its size. There's some reason to believe Triton may be the biggest satellite in the solar system, may even be the size of the planet Mars, which is really ironic because Ganymede, the biggest of the Galilean satellites, and Titan are almost exactly the same size, and they've been fighting out all through the century for the title of biggest moon in the solar system. You know, and every time somebody made another measurement of the size of one or the other would pull ahead, and now it looks as though the race is going to be won by a dark horse that we hadn't even considered, Triton. And finally, you get to Pluto, and we know very, very little about it, but now that it has a moon, we do know its density, and the thing's just a fluff ball. I mean, it has about the density of a snow cone. It is probably made of a mixture of frozen water, frozen ammonia, and frozen methane, which again is a substance that ought to be cosmically more abundant than rock, but it, in fact, is more abundant than the frozen ammonia, which we think we get in Titan. However, it boils at a very much lower temperature, and only the tiniest bit by proportion of rocky material to be left over in Pluto. So you see that there are radically different kinds of worlds in different places in the solar system, and people who think that planets ought to be made of rock and they ought to be more or less Earth-like are simply basing their assumptions on a kind of parochialism that is understandable if you stay in a given very small part of the universe and restrict all your attention to that and act as though there was something normal about it. Earth is not the normal one. It is these, by our standards, utterly alien worlds that are. Try to imagine the geology. Think of all the geology, all the variation that you can get out of just rock geology, and then try to imagine the sorts of landforms, the sorts of geologic processes that you are going to get in worlds that are so different from the Earth that they aren't even made of the same thing. We're beginning to get some previews of that sort of thing from the Voyager Jupiter encounters. It should be even stranger out of Saturn. Now, let me tell you about the other Galilean satellites. Let me, in fact, show you pictures of them as well. There they are, a scale diagram of the satellites down there at the bottom with the Moon and Mercury shown to scale and proceeding out from the planet Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto. Their orbits shown in correct scale at the top. Notice that all of the orbits are circular. They appear elliptical in this diagram because of perspective, but they're all almost perfect circles. Io's is not a perfect circle. Its deviation is slight but important. I'll get to that. But all of them are pretty close to circles, and also they're all directly above the equatorial plane of Jupiter, as though all of these bodies had formed out of the same thinning subcloud of gas and dust within the solar nebula that Jupiter itself formed from. And this is by comparison to the outer moons, most of which have orbits that are not circular, that are highly inclined to Jupiter's equator, half of which, in fact, don't even revolve around Jupiter in the same planet, in the same direction as the planet rotates, and these Galilean satellites all do. And so we suspect that those may be captured asteroids. But I'll have more to say about that in a moment also, more than a moment, at the end of the lecture also. So, as you go out from Jupiter, you find that Io is, in fact, made of rock. There is no water whatsoever in Io, as far as we can tell. Its surface spectrum shows no hint of water in any form, not solid, not liquid, not gaseous, not even water of hydration, which means water that is chemically combined with the other atoms that make up the minerals in its rock. Instead, what we see in the spectrum of Io is a bizarre surface that is made of sulfur and various salts, probably some table salt, sodium chloride, more sodium sulfate, such as you get in a lot of the dry lakes out west, as though there had been water on Io at some time and had evaporated and left behind these evaporite deposits. Except that if that were true, how do you have the fact that you don't even see water of hydration in these minerals? So, whatever the origin of Io's surface, it is very strange, and the bulk composition of Io, which we get from its density, is such that it's made of rock. Now, of course, I can't tell you what kind of rock, but it's made of rock.
And then you have a regularity to their compositions as you go out from all rock Io to mostly water Callisto. Io is all rock, Europa is more rock than water, Ganymede is about half and half, and Callisto is mostly water. Can you see what's happened? Jupiter, when it was forming, and when it was heated up to a temperature of several hundred thousand degrees by the compression of all that material that came together to form it, did on a lesser scale the same thing to its moon as the sun had done to its planet. That is, it boiled off the materials of low boiling point from relatively nearby, not rock. It wasn't able to do what the sun did and boil rock 36 million miles away. But it was able to boil water, which of course takes very much less heat, at a distance of a quarter of a million miles, which is where Io is. And so all the water was driven off there, and you've got to get all the way out to Callisto. You get more and more water as you go out, but you've got to get all the way out to Callisto before you finally run into a terrestrial planet that is made of what a terrestrial planet ought to be made of at Jupiter's distance from the sun. Let's show you these worlds now, as seen by Voyager 1, starting with Callisto and working in. There is Callisto. This is the darkest of the Galilean satellites. It is made of rock that is about, it has a rock surface that is about as dark as, standard blackboard, or maybe a little bit brighter than that, a little more reflective than that, but not much. And then there are these bright patches in various places, which are believed to be ice that has been excavated from below the surface by meteorite impacts. And so we have a very strange paradox, which in fact we shall see continues as we go in through the next, through the outer three Galilean satellites, and that is that their surface compositions are exactly in the opposite order to their interior compositions. Remember, Europa, number two, is more rock than water, Ganymede is half and half, and Callisto, the one you're seeing here, is mostly water on the inside, and yet their surfaces show Callisto is almost entirely this unknown dark rock. We don't know what it is. It has no spectra. It has no features in spectra. And so all we can do is rule out a lot of rocks that it isn't. We can rule out basalt, which is the most common lava in the inner solar system anyway. We can rule out most types of meteorites. We can't rule out carbonaceous chondrites, but we can rule those out for another reason, namely that Callisto has differentiated. That is, it has separated out and formed rock in some places and water in others. And carbonaceous chondrites are undifferentiated. That's why they're so exciting. They're what the solar system matter was made of before anything ever separated, before the various materials ever separated out. Ganymede has a surface that is about half some dark rock, maybe the same one, and about half ice. And Europa, the one that is mostly rock on the inside, has a surface that is totally covered by ice. As you'll still see from the Voyager 1 pictures, there is another respect in which the trend of their surfaces is exactly the opposite to the trend of their interior composition. This picture is dominated by this enormous multi-ringed basin, and that is apparently the remnants of a single meteorite crater. We don't know which of those rings was the original wall of the crater and which all the others must have been formed by some sort of process going on in the ground, shock and slumping and so on. We do know that this is the largest single feature on any known world, moon or planet, that has a common origin. It is 1,800 miles in diameter. Say again? Good deal larger than Polaris, over almost three times the diameter of Polaris. Over three times the diameter of Polaris. No, almost. I can never do arithmetic on my feet. The Caloris Basin, which is the big crater on Mercury, is about 850 miles in diameter. The biggest crater on at least the near side of the Moon is the Imbrium Basin, and that is just smaller, about 800 miles across. The biggest crater that had been known before this one was discovered in Callisto was the Hellas Basin on Mars, and that is 1,200 miles across. I don't know, though, whether I'm comparing apples and oranges and comparing the diameter of Hellas with the diameter of this one, which is half again as big, because the diameter of Hellas is the diameter of the main crater itself. The subsidiary ridges have mostly been eroded into invisibility by the Martian winds and maybe other Martian erosion processes. We don't know which of these features was the original one. And the reason that we don't know is, perhaps you're not aware, that the very largest craters on all of these worlds that I've mentioned show this multi-ring structure, and we don't really understand why. Obviously, it has something to do with the same sort of thing that happens when you throw a stone into a pond, and you get multiple rings, not just one. But We don't know why, because only the very largest craters do it. We cannot duplicate these explosions in the laboratories, to which you might add, thank God, but it means we don't understand the details of features that appear only in the very largest craters. To give you an idea of the numbers that I'm talking about, Imbrium, or Caloric, 800-mile crater, formed in single instance, in single meteorite impact, each of which had the violence of 750 billion Hiroshima-sized atom bombs, which is more atom bombs than you would have if you had been making 10 bombs a second, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, since the birth of Christ. This one is nearly three times the diameter of that, if it is in fact the outer ring, which is unlikely, that is the actual original wall of the crater. Apparently what happens is that when the crater forms, when it's very, very large, it shocks the ground around it, and then these faults develop and the ground slumps down, and so you have these multiple concentric rings. And indeed they're referred to as multi-ring bases. But on the Moon and Mars and Mercury, you can tell where the original wall is because that's the highest. On Callisto, you can't for two reasons. First of all, this whole thing just looks funny. Those of you familiar with basins, I'm sure, have already noticed that. There are way too many rings by the standards of the multi-ring basins that we see on these other worlds, and they're too close together, they're too closely spaced, and the spacing doesn't increase from one ring to the next as rapidly as it does on the rock worlds that we're already aware of. What that is probably telling us is that when you form a multi-ring basin on an ice world like Callisto, you get different kinds of processes in detail that form the multiple rings. And what that is telling us in turn is that all the rings didn't form simultaneously at the very moment of the meteorite impact. You see, the forces of these giant impacts are so big that the strength and other properties of the material in which the impact occurs are irrelevant to the final landform. You simply assume, in doing the calculations, the material is like water, it has no strength whatsoever. But the forces very rapidly dissipate, and so if you have geomorphological features which form subsequent to the moment of impact, maybe a minute later, maybe an hour later, maybe a million years later, but not at the same instant, then the strength and other properties of the surface material are important. And so the fact that a multi-ring basin looks different on an ice world than a rock world is probably telling us something we hadn't been sure of before, and that is that the other rings don't form simultaneously with the main wall of the crater itself. But the reason we can't tell which of these walls is the original crater is evident. It's just a special case of a general phenomenon, Callisto, which you'll see if you look along the edge of the planet. It's absolutely smooth. You notice this? No topography whatsoever. No hills, no valleys, no anything. It gives you the eerie feeling of looking at a world which maybe is something very different underneath, and the inhabitants don't want us to know they're there, and so they have painted this camouflage over their roofs. It looks as though the features were painted onto the surface. The reason for that, almost certainly, is that Callisto is an ice world, and in the billions of years that must have elapsed since these features formed, more on that in a second, the strength of the ice was simply not great enough to hold up ring walls, crater walls, mountains, and other features several miles in height, and they have very slowly, plastically collapsed down onto the surface. In the same way as you could imagine, silly putty doing if you let it sit around in the, you made some sort of sculpture out of it and then let it sit around in the sun on a warm summer afternoon. And so we don't know which is the original ring because all of them look the same now. Callisto's surface is the most like the Earth's moon of the Galilean satellite in that it is totally covered by craters. That fact is not obvious with the computer processing that was used to generate this picture. In the next picture, which was generated with some very special computer processing, I think it'll be pretty blatantly obvious. There is no place you can stand on Callisto and not be inside a crater. The number of craters per square thousand miles is the same as you would get in the most heavily cratered areas on the Earth's moon. But there's a strange thing about their distribution. Aside from the very large ones, you have nothing but relatively small ones, 10 miles across, that sort of thing. You don't see the intermediate-sized populations that you do see on the moon, the 50-mile craters, the 100-mile craters, the 200-mile craters. All you see is the giant, super special 1,800-mile job, and then these relatively small ones, but the relatively small ones totally cover the surface of Callisto. Well, one of the big surprises from the Apollo exploration of the moon is that the craters have not been forming more or less steadily through geologic time. Instead, almost all of them formed in an orgy of crater bombardment, meteorite bombardment, that happened during the first billion years of the solar system's 4.5 billion year history. To give you the exact number, 95% of the lunar craters, bigger than a certain very small size, in which other considerations dominate their population, 95% of the craters, say they're big enough to be seen through telescopes from Earth, are 3.5 billion years old or older. Now, I can't guarantee that the exact same numbers apply this much farther from the sun. You may be at a different distance from the source of the bombarding object, whatever that source was. If it was the asteroid belt, certainly that consideration would be important. But surely we can say that this surface, these features that you are seeing here, were formed several billion years ago, 3 billion, 4 billion years ago, of that order. In other words, Callisto is a body, number one, whose surface geomorphology is dominated by features of exogenic origin. That is, features caused by something that came from outside the planet, and not features that came from inside the planet. That's called endogenic. Examples of endogenic features, and those dominate the surface of the Earth, where we have very few craters. Examples of endogenic features are folded mountain ranges caused by collisions of different parts of the crust with each other, lava flows, which you have even on the moon, and so forth. Callisto has a surface that is almost totally dominated by exogenic features. And so in that respect, it is like the moon, and also, since those features have not been disturbed since, by subsequent activity, the only time that has existed in significant amounts in the solar system since, namely endogenic, see, the exogenic was over after a billion years, we can say that Callisto is like the moon in that it had a brief, early period of intense geologic activity, most of it, however, exogenic, and then it died. Callisto, the body of the Galilean satellites that is most unlike our moon in interior composition, has the surface that is most like our moon of all the Galilean satellites. And that is a very strange thing. Ganymede. From this distance, Ganymede, the largest of the Galilean satellites, and the one that is about half water and half rock, both in its surface and its interior, looks superficially like the Earth's moon. Especially if this picture were in black and white, a lot of you probably would be saying, gee, I think I see circular mare like the Imbrium, like Mare Imbrium, and I see features that look like the lunar rays. In fact, it turns out that that superficial similarity of appearance is highly misleading. These bright streaks are not the rays, the bright streaks of dust that are visible still around the youngest lunar craters, they've been erased around most of them, and that are dust that was thrown out by the impact that formed the crater. Instead, it turns out, when we get closer up, that these bright streaks are regions, enormous regions, tens of miles, sometimes even hundreds of miles wide, and as much as 1,000 miles or more long. Enormous regions where the crust has been furrowed, broken up into these parallel patterns of grooves, some of them large and some of them much smaller. There developed an immediate dichotomy among the reporters in the Voyager press room as to the best description for those grooves. All the California types referred to them as dune buggy tracks, but those of us from the cold north knew that in fact they were made by snowmobiles. And whatever way you like to think of them, what they apparently are is fault zones. And these are the first examples of horizontal fault motion that we have ever seen on a body other than the Earth. Here is one of the few cases on Callisto. Can you see it there? This pointer is kind of... Can you see the offset? This pointer is not the brightest in the world. Okay, I'll do it from the left now. You can see where a younger fault, a small one, has offset one of the sets of parallel faults and offset it by, about 50 miles. In most cases, however, the offset has been so extreme that we simply cannot find the two ends of any given feature. The entire surface of this body has been chewed to pieces at a time in its distant past, and I'll give you the evidence of that in a minute, by horizontal fault motion on a scale that makes even Earth's tectonics look puny. Plate tectonics is the big revolutionary set of concepts that has revolutionized Earth geology in the past 15 years, And what it says briefly is the outer portion of the Earth, the crust and the very uppermost part of the mantle, are divided into large chunks which are bounded by fault, and those are called plates, and they move around relative to one another, and it's those motions that crumple up parts of the crust at the edges of the plates to form mountains. It's those motions that are responsible for earthquakes where the two plates are grinding against one another. Much of Earth's volcanic activity is due to that, and so forth. This is not plate tectonics that we're seeing on Ganymede, not the earthly kind. There is no evidence of folded mountain building. There is no evidence of subduction, which is the process whereby one plate dives underneath another and gets swallowed up in the interior of the planet. But there has been fault motion that has chewed up the whole surface of the planet, of the moon, of the body. And then, after that happened, Ganymede II, several billion years ago, died. The proof of that is that there are many craters on top of the old chewed up folded surface. Not nearly as many per square thousand miles as you saw in Callisto. Callisto has a surface essentially unmodified from the very end of that crater formation period. In the case of Ganymede, most of the craters, the old craters, were destroyed in the period of fault motion. You do not see any remnants of them. But then the fault motion stopped, and the tail end of the crater bombardment, which might be craters. Now, to talk about the significance of that, let me go to this next slide, which is not upside down. They printed with south up for some reason. I decided to restore north up. Something that I haven't explained to you so far is that the reflectivities of each of the moons, each of the Galilean satellites, are different. Callisto is mostly this very dark rock. Europa is covered by ice. And Io is very bright, too, with all the salt and the sulfur. And so when they take the pictures, they expose them. And then when they prepare the pictures we see, they print them so that each picture will look optimally exposed. And the result of that is they all look alike as far as brightness range is concerned, and in the case of many of the pictures, they stretch the contrast so that whatever contrast there is, big or small, is shown on the final picture as being the same amount of contrast range. This is useful. If we showed you a picture of Callisto that was exposed the same way as a picture of Europa, you wouldn't be able to see anything, it'd be so dark. But you've got to realize that this has been done. And so they made up this picture for you in which the contrast is the same on all four bodies. It's been exaggerated on all four, but it's the same amount of exaggeration on all four. And the relative exposures, so to speak, are the same. And so you can see, number one, that Europa and Io are a good deal brighter than Ganymede, let alone Callisto. But also, although even Callisto is twice as reflective as the surface of our own moon, or more reflective even than Mars. But also you can see that these distant pictures of Callisto and Ganymede and Io all show circular dots. There are bright ones in the case of Callisto and Ganymede, dark ones in the case of Io. In each case, when we first saw them at this kind of resolution, we said, maybe those are meteorite craters. In the case of Callisto and Ganymede, we were right. They were meteorite craters. In the case of Io, we were definitely wrong. They were not meteorite craters. But in the case of Europa, there are no round dots that could be meteorite craters. And that may mean that the processes which have created Europa's surface are still going on at the present time, or at least have gone on reasonably enough to the present time as to destroy all of the big craters. Maybe when we get close in, we'll see, yeah, there's a peppering of small craters, and even on Earth you have a peppering of small craters, because after all, the Earth has some meteorite craters visible on it, just not very many, and you expect them to be small if there are very few of them, because the small meteorites are so much more common than the big meteorites that even this tail end of the distribution, which has always got left today, is enough to include some small ones. So, we have this trend, a very strange trend, that the more a Galilean satellite's interior is unlike our own moon, the more its surface is like our moon in being, number one, old, and number two, dominated by exogenic features. Please understand, when I talk about the age of the surface, I am not talking about the age of the moon itself. All of these, so far as we know, are the same age, and that is 4.5 billion years, 4.6 billion to be more exact. The age of the surface refers to the age of the last landform features to form over a dominant portion of the surface, in other words, that made the geomorphology that we see today on the surface of these bodies. Well, that trend, if indeed that is the trend, and remember we haven't seen Europa close up yet, climaxes most spectacularly in the case of Io. Here are pictures. Oh, I forgot to mention this. This illustrates further a point that I've already made, and that is the difference in reflectivities. There is a nice picture taken from a distance which shows Io in front of Jupiter and Europa, and you can see that they are very bright. And then if you look very, very hard, down at the bottom, I've got to admit, I can't see it from back here. Somewhere in there is Ganymede. Or, no, there it is, right there, right there. You see that? And these, obviously, are all at the same exposure. And if our moon were in this picture, it would look like some of that black sky. Even if Callisto were in this picture, it would look like that black sky, and Callisto is twice as reflective as our moon. So you see dramatically there the difference in their reflectivity. Here is another picture which shows just Io and Europa even more dramatically. This is a famous one. It's on the cover of the current issue of Sky and Telescope and so forth. But again, it's certainly one of the most magnificent pictures to come out of Voyager. It gives you a nice color comparison between Io and the Great Red Spot and Europa and some of the white clouds. So you see they're about the same reflectivity, but one is very, very red. In fact, it is redder than Mars, and the other is almost colorless white, very, very slightly yellow. Well, there is Io from a distance. You see it covered with these dark dots, and you can really forgive somebody who thought from this picture those dark dots might be meteorite craters. But as we got closer and closer in, we had better and better pictures of Io, and as Larry Soderblom, the geologist on the Voyager imaging team who was most primarily concerned with the moons as opposed to Jupiter, said Io had craters for about 20 hours. As we got closer, we found that it was like no world that has ever been seen before. Again, there was a dichotomy in the press room as to how best to describe it. My favorite description is from George Alexander, the very fine science writer of the Los Angeles Times. Rather like an orange that had been savagely attacked with an ice pick. But there are others who claim that the only possible description was a diseased pizza. In any case, the surface of Io not only doesn't have big meteorite craters, it doesn't have meteorite craters even down to the limit of resolution of the very closest pictures that were taken, and those were much closer than any of the other moons because Io was the top priority among the moons. And what that means is that Io has a surface, which is not only not dead like our own moon, which it resembles in size and interior composition. Io is the most geologically active body in the solar system, far surpassing even the Earth. We know these Galilean moons have been hit by meteorites. You can't just argue your way out of it by saying, well, there's already meteorites out there. We know they've been hit by meteorites. We see them on Ganymede and Callisto. And to explain the fact that Io doesn't even have the peppering of tiny craters that the Earth's surface does, you can only conclude that meteorite craters and everything else on that surface are being destroyed, and the entire surface is being regenerated within timescales of the order of 1 million years. That entire surface has been totally built up from scratch in less than 1/40% of the age of Io itself. And the best was yet to come. We didn't know what these strange-looking features, these dark features, were at this distance out. We got a little bit closer in, they began to look a little bit more familiar in contrast with some other things, for example, these weird jagged pits, which nobody is willing to claim to understand, or these brilliant white deposits. The only possible description for pictures like this is garish. Larry Soderblom showed one of them, and I think it was this one, in fact, and everybody went, oh, wow, you know, because he'd never seen them before. And Soderblom said, we're working on a color suppression routine for these pictures. And everybody laughed, and he was perfectly serious. The colors are so garish that it's very difficult to see the topography through them and make measurements of heights and depth. But it's obvious, even from this distance, that Io, unlike Ganymede and Callisto, does have topographic features visible on its surface. And so, to that extent at least, it behaves the way we expect a rock world to behave. Here is what the dark features turned out to be. They are volcanoes. Gigantic ones. They seem to have some sort of lava or some dark material anyway. We don't know what they're erupting. These look like lava channels, but as you see, they're intensely red. We suspect the red may be the salt damaged by exposure to the radiation in Jupiter's radiation belt. And in fact, in laboratory experiments, if you take, say, sodium sulfate and irradiate it with high-energy protons in vacuum, it turns about that color of red. The dark stuff is a mystery. It is some dark rock that, again, is darker than any that is common on Earth. If you want to believe it's the same one on the outer two moons, go right ahead. I won't stop you. But at this stage, people are being very, very cautious about being too dogmatic about the geology of a world that is as weird as this one. And the best was yet to come. This is a picture that was noticed only a week after encounter, because so much had been going on since. Linda Morabito, one of the engineers, discovered it. She was trying to fit, she had the data, she didn't have the actual picture. She had the picture printout, the computer printout of all the numbers, which for her purpose was better, and she was, or she thought, and she was trying to fit a perfect circle through the numbers to form the edge of the planet, and it simply refused to fit in this region. And so she called for a print of the picture and immediately recognized what she had. That woman is really smart. She's not a geologist, but right away, she knew what she had. She ran down the hall and grabbed the geologist. Most of them had gone home. You know, they all had to turn around and fly back once she discovered. What that is a volcanic eruption going on now, shooting matter 125 miles into space. And there is another volcanic eruption going on at the same moment. And here is the night side of Io lighted up by Jupiter light, which is considerably stronger in illuminating the night side of Io than the Earth is in producing Earthshine on our own moon. I would assume the fact that the Jupiter light is brighter over there is an artifact of the computer processing, which is considerable in this picture. Well, to make a long story short, no less than 8 simultaneously erupting supervolcanoes, each of them throwing matter 100 miles or more into space, which means that it was ejecting that matter at velocities of 1,200 miles an hour or more, and that's pretty good for a good gun. 8 simultaneously erupting volcanoes were going off on the surface of Io on the day when Voyager 1 happened to pass by it. And a number of smaller ones, merely equal to the most violent on the Earth. We don't know how many because we don't have even coverage in higher resolution of the entire surface. In fact, it turned out that we had seen one of the volcanoes erupting in the pictures that were taken of Io close up and hadn't realized it. It's that thing there. See the plume? See the plumes coming out? This is the volcano, and there are the plumes of matter coming out and falling back to the surface. Walter Sullivan of the New York Times was the first to point out that feature around it, a giant feature, looks like a heifer print. You know, your Greek mythology, that's very appropriate. Juno turned Io into a heifer when she found that Jupiter was having an affair with Io. Show you some other Io pictures very briefly. These have been widely reprinted, and I felt you probably knew less about the other moons than you did about Io, just because Io is so bizarre. So I spent a little bit less time on it than I would have for a general audience. That is apparently a lava lake. It is very, very hot, at least 400 degrees hotter than the surroundings. I realize in this picture it looks like the same color as the rest, but the infrared pictures show that it is quite different. What's the energy source for all this activity? There's no way it can be what drives plate tectonics and other geologic activity on Earth, namely radioactive heating produced inside the planet. Io is simply too small. The moon is geologically inactive for the simple reason that a small body like that cools more efficiently than a large one, and it simply is not able to keep its heat in the interior hot enough to be able to keep this kind of thing going. What is providing that energy source would have probably been the biggest single mystery of the Voyager 1 flyby had it not been for 3 very brave scientists, Patrick Reynolds, S.J. Thiel, and Ray Reynolds and S.J. Thiel, who published a paper suggesting a mechanism that would keep Io's interior hot and predicting that there would be a great deal of volcanic activity visible in the Voyager 1 pictures. They published that paper 3 days before the encounter. The encounter was on March 5th, and you can find their paper in the March 2nd issue of Science Magazine. And what they said was this: Io's orbit around Jupiter is not perfectly circular. The reason it is not perfectly circular is that the gravitational effects on Io of Europa and Callisto perturb it, distort the orbit in such a way that it does not fall into the natural circular shape that with the things going on in it I'm about to relate, it would otherwise immediately take up. And so the result is that Io is forced to have a slightly eccentric orbit, in which it goes a little bit closer to Jupiter at the near end, or a little bit farther out at the far end. Jupiter's enormous gravity, which is so great that a body at the moon's distance from the Earth, which of course around Earth takes a month to go around, at Io's distance from Jupiter takes only 2.5 days to go around, Jupiter's gravity raises very great tides, miles in size, in the solid material that Io is made of. That itself is not enough to heat up the interior. If that's all there were to the story, you would simply get a frozen tidal bulge about 8 miles high, and that would be the end of it. But as a result of Io continually moving back and forth through a range of distances from Jupiter, 4 times every week, the height of the tidal bulge flexes back and forth. It is highest when Io is closest to Jupiter, it is lowest when Io is farthest from Jupiter, and it flexes back and forth every 2.5 days through an interval of about a mile. That, the friction of that flexion, pumps so much heat into Io's interior that, according to the three people I just quoted, virtually all of the interior must be molten. And that is not true even of the Earth. I don't know if you're aware of the fact that, contrary to popular belief, most of the inside of the Earth, although it is near the melting point, is not actually at it. They said that the crust is so thin that they simply could not calculate how thin it was because there were so many little minor finicky variables that would come into effect when it is that small. And of course, as soon as you liquefy most of the planet, then you get even bigger tides. So I said the tides that Jupiter would raise in the solid matter, but now you have even bigger tides in the liquid matter. So how thick the crust is, we don't know. It probably varies from place to place. If you want to argue that lava lake is actually a place where we're seeing into the interior of the planet, nobody's going to stop you. So Io is a very, very interesting body, but in some ways, it's a freak. It wouldn't be that way were it not for the unique accident of its particular position in the solar system. Io's entire orbit is surrounded by a cloud of gases. Some of them ionized, most of them ionized, in fact, some of them not ionized. And of all those gases, one of them, namely the non-ionized sodium, actually glows in the sunlight brightly enough to be photographed with great difficulty from Earth. This is the actual picture, and they have overlaid it here on a picture of Jupiter taken from the Earth and a diagram of Io's orbit. And that black circle around Io is not a place where there's no sodium. Indeed, it's where the sodium is probably densest and brightest. But Io is so bright that it drowns out the sodium cloud unless you photograph it. So Io's orbit has this torus of material around it. The reason that the sodium cloud doesn't appear as a torus is that when it gets out about 80,000 miles from Io, and it takes about 20 hours for it to do that, that's the average time in which it becomes ionized. And the second it becomes ionized, it immediately becomes invisible. So all you have is this one banana-shaped cloud, banana color too, of sodium. Moving ahead of Io in its orbit, in fact, and the rest of it is invisible light, but it can be studied in ultraviolet. Well, it was studied in ultraviolet by both Pioneers 10 and 11 back when they got there 5 years ago, and by Voyager 1 now. And that entire cloud is 10 times hotter now and considerably denser than it was just 5 years ago. We suspect that the majority of the matter in that cloud, which is made of things like sodium, sulfur, potassium, things that are not terribly common cosmically, and so it's not coming from Jupiter, or else it would be mostly hydrogen and helium. The majority of the material in that cloud probably comes from the volcanoes of Io, and there may have been, within the past 5 years, a super eruption on Io, great enough to throw large quantities of material completely free of Io's surface. After all, why should the particular eruptions that happen to be occurring on the day we happen to fly by be the very greatest that it ever had? In fact, sulfur makes up a suspiciously large percentage of the matter of Jupiter's radiation belt. In fact, there are two components of that radiation belt, as Voyager 1 discovered, a high-energy one that has cosmic composition, mostly hydrogen and helium, and that means that its matter comes either from Jupiter or from the solar wind, and a lower-energy, although still very energetic, component, which is highly enriched relative to cosmic composition in sulfur, oxygen, and some other materials. So the whole radiation belt has at least a component in it, which is probably coming from the Io volcanoes. 5 million miles before Voyager 1 got to Jupiter, it was suddenly bombarded by sodium atoms moving at 5,000 miles a second. We suspect they came from the volcanoes of Io and were then somehow accelerated up to that enormous energy, that enormous speed, by something or other. Nobody has dared to suggest that there are volcanoes that actually shoot it out at 5,000 miles a second. 1,200 miles an hour, I mentioned before. But something or other is accelerating these sulfur atoms. And in fact, some of them are probably even reaching the vicinity of the Earth. This is something that is very interesting, but I'm going to have to skip over it very rapidly because I've already run out of the time that I was given and a little bit more. Perhaps the most bizarre single fact about Io is that Jupiter emits enormously intense bursts of radio static from a source that is somewhere inside itself, or at least in its atmosphere. They are so intense that you can pick them up here on the Earth, half a billion miles away, with a portable transistor radio, if you happen to have one that gets a short wave band on which they're emitted. And yet, what it is that turns them on and off is the position in its orbit of Io, a quarter of a million miles away. The standard theory as to what is generating these decametric radio bursts is that there exists between Jupiter and Io an enormous natural electric current, 4 million amperes in strength and half a million miles long. It is flowing, according to the theory, which not everyone accepts, along the bundle of magnetic field lines, of Jupiter's magnetic field lines, that happen to be connecting Jupiter with Io at any given moment. And that bundle of field lines is referred to as the Io flux tube. The electrons go flying out one leg, and when they get there, they discover that as a result of Io being in Jupiter's magnetic field and being electrically conductive, which it is, number one, because it's made of rock, which is very weakly conductive. Electric currents have been detected actually passing through the moon, for example. Number two, it has an ionosphere, as Pioneer 10 discovered. And number three, it's got that salt surface. And so as a result of Io being a conductor moving in a magnetic field, actually the magnetic field is moving past it as it co-rotates with Jupiter, but there's a relative motion, that's all that matters, a voltage of 400,000 volts is generated across Io. That means that as the electrons arrive at the side away from Jupiter, where the voltage is such that there's a net plus charge, they are forced over to the other side, where there's a net negative charge which repels them. This also accelerates them as a result of being forced from one side of Io to another, and down the flux tube they go, where they encounter the ionosphere of Jupiter, which is also an electrical conductor, and that completes the circuit. And it's where they hit the ionosphere, after having been accelerated in their passage across Io, that, according to the theory, they generate the decametric burst. Well, the top priority item for Voyager 1's Io flyby was actually to fly through that 4 million ampere current. By the way, the pre-Voyager figure was 1 million amperes. The observations that it made as it flew across there is up to 4. We don't know whether to be glad or sorry, but it seems to have missed the flux tube. We do not know whether that current would have been a danger to the spacecraft because we have no idea over what volume of space it flows. Does it take place over the entire cross-section of Io, or does it bundle up towards the center of the flux tube, or are there rods within it which are denser, or what? And we also don't know too much about the details of how energetic the electrons would have been. But in any case, Io flew near enough to the flux tube to measure the magnetic field induced by that flowing current. And it's from that measurement that we get indirectly the estimate of 4 million amperes for the size of the current. I'm going to skip very briefly over the material that I had about Jupiter's outer moons. We simply have run out of time. There are at least 8 of them. Their names in order out from the planet are Leda, Himalaya, Alara, Lysithea, Ananke, Carme, Pasiphae, and Sinope. And they fall into 2 groups. One revolving in the normal direction for rotations and revolutions in the solar system, averaging about 8 million miles from Jupiter and pretty closely bunched at 8 million miles. The other going in the wrong direction, averaging about 15 million miles from Jupiter, but going at the far end in the case of not the outermost in average distance, which is Sinope, but the next one in average distance, Pasiphae. So you've got another Neptune-Pluto kind of situation. You know, which one is the farthest out? They go as far as 20 million miles from Jupiter, and that means that's almost as far as Venus is from the Earth. You know, again, it illustrates how enormous Jupiter's gravitational field is, and that means that they are so far out, and also so small, that you would need a 6-inch telescope to see them from Jupiter. So you mustn't think that Jupiter has 13 moons up in the sky, or 14 as the case may be. They aren't all visible by any means. And for the same reason, the Voyagers weren't able to do much of a study of them because, you know, Voyager 1 comes in on one side and it is tens of millions of miles from the moons on the other side. It did take 2 pictures of the 2 brightest, which may mean they're the 2 biggest, and those are both in the inner group of outer moons, the 8 million mile group, and they are Ilara and Himalaya. Those pictures enjoyed such a high priority that when I made the mistake of asking 2 members of the Voyager imaging team about them, just as the Io excitement was beginning to peak, One of them couldn't remember whether they had been taken yet, and the other didn't know they were going to be taken. One of these days we'll get them. They will be very, very tiny images, only a few pixels in size, pixels being the little dots the pictures are made of. But even that will be enough to give a size, something about shape and reflectivity. There is something known about average size and reflectivity from the Earth-based observation, and we know that both of them are made of exceedingly dark rock, possibly carbonaceous chondritic. We did, however, here are pictures of Amalia and Hilaria from Earth and two other outer satellites that apparently overmade the slide I couldn't identify. We did get the one picture of one of the little moons of Jupiter that was pretty good from Voyager 1. It was taken from 500,000 miles away, but those cameras are so good, it was still pretty good. This is Amalthea, which is a weird one. It is the only one that is closer to Jupiter than the Galilean satellite. It is small, like the Galilean satellite, but it has an orbit that is perfectly circular and perfectly above Jupiter's equator. It is small like the outer satellites, but it has the same kind of orbit as the Galilean satellites do, perfectly circular, perfectly above Jupiter's equator. And here is our best picture of Amalthea. I'm afraid the most obvious thing on that picture is a streak of dust, but ignoring that, it is actually redder than I've shown it here. When I made this slide, I did so in a great hurry, and I'm afraid I overexposed it a bit. Amalthea is even redder than Io, and even darker than Callisto. Amalthea is in fact now the reddest known object in the solar system. And I asked David Morrison, who is an asteroid person on the Voyager imaging team, if he could tell me any asteroids, because, you know, the theory is these little ones may be captured asteroids despite Amalthea's orbit. I asked him whether he could tell me any asteroids that have that kind of darkness and redness combined. And he said there are none. But the ones that come closest are not in the main asteroid belt. They are the Trojan asteroids, which orbit around the Sun in Jupiter's own orbit, but 60 degrees ahead of and behind Jupiter in the L4 and L5 points, for those of you who are familiar with those. So it's conceivable that Amalthea is a captured Trojan, or that the Trojans are escape moons of Jupiter. On the other hand, it is also very conceivable that that redness is simply a sunburn induced on Amalthea by 4.5 billion years, or whatever the number might be, since it was captured, if it was captured, of exposures to Jupiter's radiation belt. Indeed, those three bright things, which are not really white, remember, this is a dark object, so the exposure makes it look a good deal brighter than it is. They're really a dark gray, but they're gray, not red. Those may be crater ejecta blankets, which have brought up material from underneath the superficial red coating and tried to show us what the true color of Amalthea actually is. What's next? Galileo. That is what used to be called Jupiter Orbiter Probe. It's now got a fancy name of its own, a very appropriate one for the person who discovered the Galilean satellite. It will be launched by the Space Shuttle, the first U.S. planetary mission to be launched by the shuttle. It will be launched in 1982. It will do a gravity assist past Mars, believe it or not, and go on to Jupiter, taking 3 years to get there. It will arrive in 1985. And at that time, a probe, a single probe, not four like Pioneer Venus, couldn't afford that, single probe will detach itself from the orbiter and go into Jupiter itself and survive as far as it can, descending down through that hot, dense atmosphere. The remainder will then go into orbit around Jupiter, its Galileo orbiter, and it will keep track of Io, for example, and see what kind of time scale its variation takes place on. It will make repeated close flybys of the other Galilean satellites, and in general should greatly enhance our knowledge, since it can stay there and watch changes go on in both Jupiter and the Moon, even over what we learned from Voyager 1. But I think for the time being, Voyager 1 is certainly staggering enough. Thank you very much. I got one more thing to show you. I forgot all about this, and the planetarium went to a lot of trouble to get it together. Here is a picture of the taken by our special representative on the surface of Io, which shows you what it looks like to be standing on that world. It is a very up-to-date picture. There is an erupting volcano over there, you will see. I'm seeing this really for the first time myself because I wasn't dark adapted when I saw it before. It's a great picture. And there is Jupiter, an actual Voyager 1 photograph, it looks to me, am I right? And the ring, too visible. And the only thing, and you can see the other Galilean satellites up there in the sky, and even Amalthea, and the only thing that I would add to this picture is the sky should be a very pale yellow, because that sodium cloud, the visible portion of the Io plasma torus, well, this isn't plasma, this is non-ionized, is actually bright enough that it's about the brightness of a faint aurora. But I think it's a really good picture, and I'm very happy they had it here. myself. Thank you.
Okay, I got to go home. Unfortunately, I cannot stay even for the rest of this program, let alone tomorrow. So if you want to grab those handouts, please do so now. The other handout is the very fine sky calendar, which is published by the Michigan State Planetarium. And it's the best thing that I know of keeping track on a day-to-day basis of what is going on in the naked eye sky.